The game plan so far was to follow what I thought was the textbook by Binion Tremé. Now it turns out that the second edition of this book is drastically different from the first, and I had not realized this. So what I told you the previous time about the various paragraphs we'd be doing is at least numerically wrong, and it turns out that in the entire chapter 10 about dark stuff has disappeared for reasons beyond my understanding, but I have ordered the second edition of the book, which should arrive sometime this week, so I hope to make up for this. My apologies for the lack of clarity. Even so, let me repeat what the intended order of events is. Having seen more or less globally what the problem at hand is, I should like to talk first about how the Newtonian equation of motion for stellar dynamics generates a general interest in potentials, and I will try to explain to you why potentials are, in a sense, more important than forces. We will follow the book, or at least what I think is my version of the book, on some of the more plausible potentials, the sort of ready-made things that turn out to be useful in stellar dynamics. And we will skip elliptical distributions, except for the elliptical velocity distribution, which I will get to talk about later this morning. About orbits, we will then reiterate how the extent to which an n-body system can be seen as a collection of stellar orbits and how this is an extension of ordinary two-body theory. I have already explained to you the previous time why two-body and three-body encounters are extremely important, and I'll be coming back to this frequently. As an aside, I will talk a little bit then after that, that'll be probably in about 3 weeks or so, about the so-called epicyclic approximation, which is a very useful thing in particular because stellar dynamics has split off a sort of side branch, as it were, that is relevant for the formation of planetary systems, where rather a large quantity of the same dynamics that we will be talking about here is in fact applicable. And it turns out that in order to understand at least to a second approximation what planetary formation does, we will talk about the epicyclic approximation. Then we will talk about pseudo-equilibria. I think I have already mentioned to you frequently, and I will be coming back to this again and again, that there is no such thing as an equilibrium in an n-body stellar system, but sort of temporary equilibria. We will be talking about timescales later this morning when we talk about potentials. And, of course, we also need to talk about stability. By that time, it will be necessary to put things in on a more or less formal basis, and we'll be talking a little bit more about kinetic theory. I will be talking about this every now and then, sort of introducing this step by step as we proceed. For instance, when we get to be talking about the velocity and position distribution of stars, I will be looking forward, as it were, to formal kinetic theory. Just a question, show of hands. Who among you has attended a course in thermodynamics? You, two, three, that's sort of partial. Okay, I'll take this into account. Thank you very much. And then, since it turns out that chapter 10 about dark stuff has disappeared from the second edition of the book, I'll just have to make do, possibly with my own notes and possibly referring to the older edition of the book, which then I think you can look up in the library. In the context of today's, I mean, I really mean 21st century astrophysics, one cannot really do without at least a reasonable covering of dark stuff and the role of dark stuff in the universe. I hope that it will happen during your lifetime. Maybe your own PhD will contribute to this, that we will find out what those 96% of the universe actually are. And we do believe currently that the study of stellar dynamics may have a contribution to give there. Well then, the ingredients in all of stellar dynamics and everything that we will be talking about here are the following. First, we'll be talking about the dynamics As I had already mentioned, in this respect, my approach to this subject is different from the line of reasoning of the book, including the second edition. The line of reasoning of the book more or less starts with what will be the second part today, which is potential theory. Okay, sort of what do gravitational potentials do and what do they look like? In my opinion, the dynamics of an n-body system, as epitomized by this deceptively simple equation of motion, is rather more important than anything else. And the reason for this mostly being that, as I had already indicated, there is no such thing as a equilibrium solution to a gravitational n-body system. There will be solutions that have a relatively long timescale. Again, we'll be talking about timescales in a moment, but dynamics is of the essence. Incidentally, those of you who wish to connect stellar dynamics with the universe as a whole, with the evolution of the universe as a whole, I hope will realize by now that the fact that our universe itself is exceedingly far out of equilibrium, right? It has a beginning, there's a Big Bang, we have Hubble expansion, it's only 13.7 billion years old and things, that all of this contributes to what we currently see of n-body gravitational systems. Had the universe lived forever, it would be completely out of the question to see such a thing as a globular cluster or a stellar aggregate like a galaxy. You would have had infinite amount of time to end up in this so-called gravithermal catastrophe that I talked about the previous time. That is to say, two particles infinitely close together and everybody else scattered to infinity. So, interestingly enough, there is this link. And it is no coincidence that the characteristic timescale of the pseudo-equilibrium systems that we see today, such as, for instance, globular clusters, elliptical galaxies, that their characteristic timescale is almost exactly the same as the age of the universe. This is not a coincidence, right? This is because the universe as a whole is extremely far out of equilibrium, and linked to this, an n-body gravitational system cannot be itself in equilibrium. So these two things play together, which comes back to this. This is my overwhelming reason for having the dynamics in a central position in this particular course. Now then, it all hinges, of course, on what this acceleration is due to. Normally speaking, one computes the acceleration as a negative gradient of a scalar function of space and time, a potential. We'll treat this in more detail in an instant. It is this simplification, however, that I argued the previous week is not necessarily applicable under all circumstances. This presumes that the only interaction present in the system is a gravitational interaction. And this, as we had already seen, cannot be maintained. For instance, during some phases in the evolution of globular clusters, the density of stars in the center of the cluster becomes so large that the physical size of stars becomes important, and tidal effects do have their consequences, and they do not contribute to this particular expression for an acceleration. You have to put that in extra. Similarly, if, as we'll be talking about in a moment, there is some gas left over from the start of a stellar system, from the birth of a stellar system, or if gas has been added by stellar winds or stellar explosions during the evolution of this system, and if this gas remains bound to the stellar system somehow, then again, this is an oversimplification. There are other cases in point as well. You may wonder, for instance, why it is that, for example, magnetic fields do not play much of a role in the considerations I have given so far. Well, the reason for this can be understood relatively readily. Whereas in gravity, the potential goes as 1 over r, the magnetic potential, scalar speaking, goes as 1 over r squared. And you are hopefully all aware that the reason for this is that there are no such things as magnetic charges. There are only magnetic dipoles in the universe, which means that the fields and therefore the forces decay with 1 power of R more steeply than gravitation. Right, and that is why they do not play a significant role under these circumstances. Well then, there is another reason to keep that potential as a central idea, and this will link to some of the courses you will hopefully be taking in the remainder of your master's series. The question now is, having given this prescription for the acceleration, I still have to give a prescription for the potential. And that, of course, ought to be related back again to the distribution in space of all the masses that are relevant in this particular system. There again, I will deviate a little bit from the order of events in the book. In the book, people start by giving a potential as proportional to 1 over R. Now, this may have been perfectly okay in the 17th century when Hooke and Newton invented this force law, 1 over R squared, which, of course, relates to the potential being a 1 over R function. That, however, is the world in reverse. Right? It is no, so there's no specific significance to this point mass distribution. What rather is the case is that the equation that in the book is derived from a sum over all of these individual potentials for the individual stars this equation over here, Poisson's equation, is the central issue over here. And now the reason, of course, is you have a mass density here, so many kilograms per cubic meter. That mass density via this equation generates a potential. That potential via this equation generates an acceleration. And that then you put in the equations of motion. Now then, why is it that from the physics point of view, I consider this more fundamental than this? The reason for this is that this is a special case of general relativity theory. As it happens, Einstein formulated his field equations for general relativity by analogy with this equation over here. We know that this theory, classical mechanics and classical Newtonian gravity, is, you can't say wrong, but it is insufficient. All right, it is simply not tenable in a relativistic world, whereas general relativity is. In the limit of velocities that are very much smaller than the speed of light, general relativity theory reduces to Poisson's equation, which is why I think that this is more fundamental than the other forms, and that is why I like to put it at central stage over here. So our task at hand now is to come up with some reasonable examples of this. And before we do that, I will do two things. One is I will try to link these two together and show you that this function over here is what is called the characteristic function of the Laplacian operator over here. And the second thing is I will talk about the way in which in this particular formulation the consistency problem that I was talking about earlier raises its head, and why it is that we will be looking for potentials and combinations of potentials and the distribution of particles in velocity and in space. Well then, let us see what we can find about this particular operator. Let us assume for the moment that we try to solve it in the case of a completely empty universe. Now, this seems like a silly thing to do, but those of you who sometime during their education will follow quantum field theory will be completely familiar with the idea that it is already very hard to explain properly what the vacuum does and what a single particle does. Well then, the Laplacian operator looks like this in in three space, and that is just for an ordinary rectangular Cartesian coordinate system. Of course, if you want to do it in spherical coordinates, you can do it a little bit more easily in the steps compared with the steps that I'll be taking here, except then you have to explain why the Laplacian has this particular form in spherical coordinates. You can find it in various textbooks. It turns out that if you release this operator on the function 1 over r, which is x squared plus y squared plus z squared to the minus 1/2, all right, then you find that that equals 0. And I think you can already see where that comes from. The first derivative, I'll just do it in one coordinate, right? First derivative will give you 1/2 times this whole expression, okay, r to the minus, r squared, I should say, to the minus 3/2 times the first derivative of x squared, 2x, and this cancels against that. Then you will see that the second derivative of this will do two things. First, it will give you this part where the x disappears. Second, you will get x squared where this remains. And then if you add the whole thing together, you will turn out to get 0. Therefore, this thing over here is important as a characteristic function of that particular Laplacian operator, which, of course, mathematically speaking, is a justification for being able to build up any distribution at all by a proper integral over where you have a density function multiplied with this particular characteristic function. And it is that density function, of course, that appears over here. While we have this over here, let us see where the consistency problem arises here. It arises at this particular point, of course. Having solved, hopefully you can do that, having solved for the velocity distribution of all the entire system over here, you have some sort of collection. I will put them as a set now. You have a collection of velocities. Then what you can do is you take at a given position in space all particles, whatever their velocity is. All right. In other words, you integrate over velocity space. You don't care what the velocities are. You just simply take a little cube in 3 space. And in that cube in 3 space, you count all the stars and you treat on an equal footing stars that go this way and stars that go that way and stars that go that way and so on. Instantaneously. So you then get a function of time, and it is that density distribution then that has to produce this density over here. And now you can immediately see, even just graphically, where the consistency problem arises that we have been talking about earlier. If you wish to have a system in equilibrium, it is necessary for this whole loop to work properly in both directions. In other words, this cause of events, all right, where you have a density and a potential, from a potential find an acceleration, from the potential find a velocity, you must needs reproduce a set of points here, a particle distribution, that does properly correspond to this density over here. And I hope that you see that this is by no means guaranteed. Right? So, barring questions that for a mathematician might be interesting, such as, for instance, if we have a prescribed density distribution, do you find a potential that is unique? Right. And if you have a potential, do you find an acceleration that is unique, and so on and so forth? There is still the almost certainty that this particular loop will not properly close. And in fact, I have tried to argue that it never can. Right, and we'll have to see later where precisely this happens. It turns out that the evolutionary problems that arise here are hidden in a very sneaky fashion. They are hidden here, where I take the average, look at these set brackets, where I take the average over all particles in a given volume, no matter what their velocities are. That is to say, in this step, I have basically thrown away information. I have not cared whether the particles move this way, that way, or the other way, and so on and so forth. And therefore, that means that that information arises again, as it were, resurrects itself in this part, in this branch of the whole distribution. So even if I were to start all the particles in my distribution here that give me my mass density, kilograms per cubic meter, no velocity, okay, kilograms per cubic meter, nothing else, then this equation of motion has this sneaky time in there. And therefore, it will generate velocities. It will produce velocities that I have left out deliberately over here. Why have I left them out? Because the only thing that is required in this whole thing is a mass density. There is no velocity term in here. Had this been electrodynamics, for instance, life would have been different. As you're perfectly well aware, there are things like Lorentz forces and things like that that do play a role in the dynamics of electromagnetic systems. There's no such term in here. There are no velocity terms. So I hope that you realize from this how subtle these things can be. If you design, like you will in the course of Professor Portugis, if you design your own numerical methods for tackling this particular problem, I think that you can already see where your biggest difficulties are going to lie. They're going to lie in this step here, in the construction of the density distribution from a given velocity distribution. All right. Another thing that even without having solved this problem, even without having solved this particular set of equations, this particular scheme, as it were, I think you can already see where another problem in the whole situation arises. And that, in its turn, is hidden over here in the characteristic function of the Laplacian. It was built, of course, in order to accommodate the sort of embryonic guess by Hooke and Newton that gravity works like this. Right? We now know that it works like general relativity, but never mind that. There's two things over here. One is 1 over r is a power law. R to the minus 1. Power laws are scale-free. There is no intrinsic scale of length in 1 over r. There's no intrinsic scale of time in 1 over r. Right? They're just simply, you can take an n-body system and you just multiply all distances with a fixed factor and you will get an equally valid solution to your equations. Right? That means, however, that the problems with timescales and the problems with bottomless energy, as it were, arise precisely here. Because this is the quadratic function that goes in here. If you look back at how this mass density is generated, then that means that it is perfectly possible that somewhere in your system you have a mass density that for practical purposes goes to infinity. And the reason for this could be that if you have two particles that get infinitely close together, where r becomes zero, this thing explodes and becomes very, very, very large. You may say, well, that doesn't really matter because I can always add a constant to this function over here, which, as you are perfectly well aware from this formulation, will differentiate away. But you can't in this particular case, right? Because never mind how much of a constant you add or subtract, if this goes to infinity, then that will not really help you. All right. So effectively, all the ingredients of our n-body system are already in here. Now, what is not in here is a quantitative understanding. I think that when you did the practical exercises last week with Dr. Anders Fumagalli, is shown to you how important it is to have at least a working knowledge of the actual quantities, okay, such as the mean free paths that you were talking about the previous time. And before we continue, I'd like to do one more step on this Poisson equation. Now, there's space enough, so let's do that here. What I should like to do is to consider the characteristic scales of this set of equations. As I think you're aware now, solving them in practice will be technically hard. To begin with, you have a second-order partial differential equation to solve here that you will then have to differentiate once to find this, which then you have to integrate twice in order to get the orbits of the particles. Right? So that is technically challenging. And before we do that, it will be interesting to see what in general we can expect quantitatively. So for the moment, I have only been talking about the qualitative aspects of the mathematics of this set of equations that we'll basically have to deal with all the time. And sort of even though they won't be on the blackboard, this set of things will cast a shadow over the entire lecture series. Let us consider what we can do just simply by looking at quantities. Well then, let us look at the equation for the acceleration over here. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to first remove the spatial dependence of this, and then I'm going to replace this differentiation by a characteristic scale. So where we had the d by the x, okay, the rate of change of this quantity in any given coordinate direction. And I just simply say, if I'm only interested in quantities, I mean so many meters or parsecs or astronomical units or whatever you want, then I'm justified in saying this, right, that the dimensional behavior of these will look that the acceleration behaves like the dimension of a potential divided by the dimension of length. We also know that an acceleration has the dimension of meters per second squared, right? So we can put this thing over here. That's a velocity over time, right? That's the equation we have over here. And a velocity, of course, has the dimension of a length over time squared. So we have that is a length over square of a time. Right then. When then finally we put this, okay, you find what the dimension of the potential is over here. All right, this x squared over t squared, velocity squared. So it's an energy dimension, basically, right? And that is something you already knew. If you put that in here, you will get something that is really quite remarkable. The Poissonian, the Laplacian operator has a dimension of 1 over a length squared, right? So if we ask ourselves what the Laplacian behavior of this is, the x squared just simply disappears. And this then has the dimension of 0. In other words, I come to the conclusion that the time dimension scales as the inverse square root of g times the mass density. And this is an equation that I demand you memorize if you didn't know it already. All right. If ever you are stuck for finding a characteristic timescale, I mean really a timescale in seconds or years or whatever your time unit of preference is, this is something to remember. I'm going to do one example, and I'm going to ask my teaching assistant to come up with some of those tomorrow morning for other stellar systems, right? I mean truly quantitatively. let us consider. You are sitting at a colloquium, right? And you have to sort of know this straight away. Well, let's consider what it is in the case of planet Earth, for instance. Well, for planet Earth, it looks like this. Yeah, this to the minus 1/2, and what goes in here, G is 6.66 times 10 to the minus 11. Oh, by the way, I use SI units. I mean, damn you astronomers, right? I mean, I just flatly refuse to use parsecs and astronomical units and things all mixed up. So G is, shall we say, 7 times 10 to the minus 11. All right. Mass density of Earth. Well, we know that the mass density of the oceans is 1 ton per cubic meter, so 1,000 kilograms per cubic meter. And Earth is made of rock, so it's approximately twice as much. Right. So you say this will be something of the order of 2 times 10 to the 3, something of that general sort. Well, then, you end up with this number over here, which looks like 14... times 10 to the minus 8, and that all to the minus 1/2. Well, 14 is almost 16, and square root 16 is 4. So what you end up with something is something of the order of, okay, 1/4 times 10 to the 4 seconds. All right. That's about, well, 10 to the 4 seconds. An hour is 3,600 seconds. So what we have over here is something of the order of 1 hour. And you knew this, because in every newspaper on the front page you can read that this silly person, Andrei Kuipers, who is currently skimming the upper layers of our atmosphere, which he thinks is space, is orbiting at a timescale of approximately 1.5 hours. Right? And that's because of this order of magnitude estimate. If you want to check in the textbook, where they have sort of a small overview here and there of a characteristic distances between stars in globular clusters and characteristic timescales. For instance, the typical core size of a globular cluster is something of the order of 10 to the 17 meters or thereabouts. You will find that for a typical stellar mass of the order of 10 to the 30 kilograms, you will end up with a characteristic speed, which you can derive from this timescale, of course, or something of the order of 5 kilometers per second, which is something that I have just been loosely quoted when I showed you the picture of Messier 80 in the previous lecture. Remarkably enough, those of you who have already taken a course in cosmology will recognize in here straight away an expression for the Hubble parameter. The Hubble parameter is 1 over a time scale. The dimension of the Hubble parameter at the present is 1 over the dimension of a time scale, and therefore is directly proportional to this square root of the density over here, like this. And if I tell you that your typical mean cosmic density at present is approximately 1 hydrogen atom per cubic meters, you know the mass of the hydrogen atom is 10 to the minus 27 kilograms, you can find out straight away whether or not that fits more or less with what is observed for the Hubble parameter. All right. And the inverse Hubble parameter is an estimate of the time scale of our universe, which turns out to be 10 to the 18 seconds or something of that general sort. Right. So if here you were to fill in the mass density of, shall we say, you know, the local cluster of galaxies, 1 atom per cubic meter, you get a time scale of the order of 10 to the 17, 10 to the 18 seconds, or something like that. All right. It always works. It is totally brilliant. Even stronger, if it doesn't work, you have something serious. Okay, you have something serious by the head. We'll be coming back to this all the way at the end of the lecture series, because it turns out that once upon a time, somebody noticed a deviation from this general behavior in clusters of galaxies. Again, they're stellar systems to a certain approximation. That was Fritz Zwicky, who in 1926 realized that the velocities of the galaxies in the Virgo and Coma cluster of galaxies is very much bigger than what you would expect on the basis of the amount of light that you see those galaxies emit. Now, the mass density, of course, is predicated in astronomy on the assumption that your typical stars like the Sun and your typical mass-to-luminosity ratio is like the Sun or something very, very similar. If you fill that in here, you get a timescale that doesn't tally with what you infer from the velocities in such a system. And Zwicky concluded from this that galaxies, or at least clusters of galaxies, are something of the order of 3, 4, maybe even 5 or 6 times more massive than you could find in the presence of galaxies. It's one of the very, very first indications of the presence of dark stuff in our universe. Right? And this all came from something totally simple, something like this. Well, I say totally simple. There is, in fact, a more complicated version of this, that we'll be coming back to this at approximately 2/3 of the course, and that is the so-called Virial theorem. Because what I've done here is, as you can already see from the course of arguing, I've wiped out all spatial behavior here. I've wiped out all velocity structure. I just simply said, let's just simply look at the way things behave dimensionally. That works up to factors of pi or square root 5 or something of that general sort. However, it is possible to do things in a much more simple, more subtle way by going back effectively to this pair of equations and taking an average, a proper mathematically suitable average, over all velocities and positions. So it is similar to this operation over here, except that not only do you take an average over all velocities, you also take an average over all densities. Then you end up with an equation in which the dynamic behavior, the kinetic energy of a system as is present over here, and the potential of the system as it is present over here, are taken into account on an equal footing, which is, of course, what you should do if you're more precise than this. And that gives you something that is, in a sense, reminiscent of this thing over here, and that is known that is known as the Virial theorem. And at present, I put this in extremely heavy quotation marks because this is, of course, not the Virial theorem, but is an embryo thereof. And later, when we discuss this system in more detail and we do the kinetic theory of this properly, you'll see shades of this simple expression coming back to you. To conclude on this, is this something that we could already have known? Yes. When you look at this behavior over here, when you look at this particular form of dimension, you will see that this is, in effect, nothing other than Kepler's third law, that the square of a time scale is proportional to the cube of a length scale in our solar system. P squared, where P is the orbital period, scales as R cubed, where R is the mean orbital distance, mean orbital size, mean orbital radius, or the semi-major axis, if you want to be a little bit more precise. So you can see that all these things hang together, and they're all consequences, effectively, of this rigid scheme that I've put on over here. All right, so this casts its shadow over everything that we will be doing. Well then, how are we going to proceed? Well, there are several ways ahead, and for the moment I will come back to following the trajectory of the book. One of the things one could do, for instance, is say, well, this is all fair enough if you can talk about a mass density, so many kilograms per cubic meter. However, what we could do instead is take completely the other side of the coin. That is to say, rather than taking continuous function of space like this one over here, we could go back to taking a sum over individual particles. So simply saying I have a sum of point masses where for every point mass I know what its potential is. So by a simple summation over all space, I know what this is going to be. That is the latter course of action is interesting if you start, for instance, with a two-body problem. And you can show, as they do in the textbooks, that there is a nice exact solution to this and so on and so forth. However, as I think you are aware, and at least I already mentioned this the previous time, this does not work in the case of more than two bodies, and it doesn't even work in the case of two bodies if they move so fast that this is no longer a good approximation, and you need to take general relativity into account. For instance, I had already mentioned that this potential is scale-free, and therefore you can sort of scale this down and down and down and down until this becomes infinite. However, again, by looking at the time scales, you will notice that this density then goes up and up and up and up and up and up without limit, which means that your time scale gets smaller and smaller and smaller without limit, which means that for a given size, your velocity will exceed the speed of light. And therefore, you can make this so small that the motions as follow from this equation of motion in your system become relativistic, in which case you know perfectly well that this no longer applies and you must use general relativity. And in fact, this does occur. We know from the binary pulsar, for instance, that gravitational radiation not only exists, but it obeys Einstein's equations of general relativity. And this binary star system loses energy due to gravitational radiation. It has been directly observed. Now, that's only for one binary star that we happen to know in our galaxy. But, of course, as you can realize, in a stellar system in general, it is perfectly possible for this to occur, which harks back to something that I said earlier in this lecture today, that it is rather remarkable that we can only talk about things like this by virtue of the fact that our universe as a whole is very, very far out of equilibrium and is comparatively young, 13.7 billion years. Now, had our universe lived forever, then effects like gravitational radiation losses, no matter how small, would ultimately, in the fullness of time, have started to play a role in this scheme of things. Right? So even if you thought you had point masses, okay, nothing special, no stars with a finite size, no gas, no nothing, right? Then still, your system would have undergone this gravitational catastrophe that I was talking about earlier. A question?
What is the best and most useful way to gravitational radiation?
That is a very hard question. I have seen a large number of attempts at visualizing potential fields like this, density fields, force fields, shear fields, and so on and so forth. That is already very, very hard. To visualize gravitational radiation is even worse. The reason for this effectively being that gravitational radiation is in and of itself 11-dimensional. That is to say, a gravitational wave is in effect a stress energy momentum tensor in four-dimensional space-time. Now, since this is symmetric, you get 4 times 4 minus, et cetera, et cetera. So you get 11 independent components, right? In my opinion, this is hopeless. As some of you may be aware, part of my existence, I'm a visual artist, and I have, in fact, struggled with this problem, how to render things. Our input channels, okay, our eyes and things like that, are just plain simply not geared to this. You can try it with, like people have tried with vector arrows and stuff, and it drives you absolutely bats, right? They just simply seal these things that you can't make head or tail out of it. People have tried with colors, okay? If anyone can do it, they will have my eternal gratitude, but I don't think that it is currently possible. The group around Kip Thorne, where I used to work at Caltech, has put up a valiant effort in trying to do this, and they're still struggling in this general direction, but I'm afraid there's nothing for it for the moment.
What would it look like if you leave out 8 dimensions? And
The problem with gravitational radiation is that it does not really have a lower dimensional analog, so we're more or less stuck with it. It is in principle possible to visualize something like a plane gravitational wave, right? Just a localized plane gravitational wave train, I should actually say. But already that is so bizarre that it will take a long time for your eye-brain combination to get accustomed to. I'm sorry for that.